writer of this particular email asked me, why can't I do like my friend said? He said to just take a hunk of cable, you know, and coil it up, these feed lines, coil it up, and that will give me a very high, supposedly XL, and directly feed that to the 450 ohm line. And I think I see why they went this 4 to 1,000. More to it than that, but this is basically the outline. Over.
Yeah, there's a slim chance, Mel, I'm not sure, that you might be slightly mispronouncing the word balance. Baker Alpha Lima Uniform November. Not Mike, November. Balance to unbalance. So it's a B-A-L-U-N. I'm not sure if I'm hearing a slightly different pronunciation. And the main reason for a balance is that if the antenna is, say, for instance, a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a dipole, to just bring a raw piece of coax cable up to the dipole, connect the antenna conductor to one side and shield to the other side, it definitely works. But it will launch excess current flowing down the outside of the cable because the dipole itself tries to act in a balanced manner. You could say a dipole is a pair of monopole antennas back to back. Each half of the dipole tries to act as the counterpoise for the other half, thoroughly balanced system. Another way of putting it is that when the dipole is running correctly, if the right-hand side at this instant was plus 1 volt, at that exact same instant, the left-hand side should be minus 1 volt. So when you feed that dipole and you get that balanced condition, and the condition comes about because everyone wants to believe a 70 ohm dipole acts like a pure 70 ohm resistor. You put a 70 ohm resistor at the end of your cable and test it across your favorite frequency region, and you'll get a very flat curve of 1-to-1 standing wave ratio if you're using 70 ohm coax cable. Put a 70 ohm impedance dipole and you see something very different. The standing wave ratio curve would be a bathtub or a V-shaped curve. As you go a little bit above or a little bit below the center design frequency, the standing wave ratio starts climbing pretty fast. So even though we call it a 70 ohm impedance dipole, it really is only 70 ohm at one specific frequency, the center of the design frequency. As you go a little bit off, all kinds of things are happening. That's a very strong clue. You dig considerably deeper into the issue and you find out that what a dipole does to radiate a signal into space is not easy. We all think radiation is easy. You take a dollar's worth of wire and with egg insulators and you hang it up in the air with a polypropylene rope and you put a feed line on it, you send some signal into it, and the signal goes radiating in space. It looks easy. It isn't. The RF energy doesn't just jump off that wire and go into space. That signal has to bounce back and forth on that wire something like 30 times before it finally gets radiated into space. It's a resonant network, a so-called standing wave structure. That signal has to bounce back and forth between the opposite ends of the dipole 30 times. So what we call resonance and tuning of the dipole is carefully adjusting that length so that those 30 bounces all stay in step, co-phase with each other. That high reactance that you see, you go a little bit above the design frequency, and rapidly the antenna starts acting like an inductor. Go a little bit below design center frequency, and it rapidly starts acting like a capacitor. Well, capacitive reactance, inductive reactance, that really means in-phase leading or in-phase lagging. In general, you put an inductor across the end of a transmission line, and you're creating a reflecting signal that lags in phase compared to a resistor. Put a capacitor at the end of your transmission line, and you get a reflected signal that leads in phase compared to a resistor at that location. So you're really seeing the fact that all those bounces fall out of phase. That's why the standing wave ratio climbs so rapidly. So now that you accept the fact that radiation is difficult, that signal has to be kicked in the can 30 times before it finally jumps off that wire and radiates into space. That gives you another little bit of a clue that the dipole tries very hard to act like a balanced structure. Plus one volt on the right side and negative minus one volt on the left side at that instant of time. So it's going to launch current down the outside of your coax cable if you don't put a balancing device at the end of the cable. This is not necessarily bad, as long as you can accept the fact that you want your coax cable to be part of the radiating system. And in some cases, you want that. That could be good. But if you really want to have complete control, where only the dipole does the radiating and your feed line does not do the radiating, you've got two choices. Feed it with a balanced feed line, like twin lead or lateral line, but, you know, balanced-looking feed line is one way to feed it, and you won't have a problem with the feed line being part of the radiator, or put a balancing device. The balancing device takes the coax in at one end, and it acts like balanced 300 ohm or whatever transmission line coming out of the other end. It creates the balance. That's why it's called a balance. And so the way you couple your valuable RF energy out of your transmitter into your antenna, there isn't one way. There isn't five ways. There's a zillion ways. There's a lot of different transmission lines that if you're smart enough, you can make them work. I don't care if the transmission line is high impedance, low impedance, balanced or unbalanced, shielded twin lead, unshielded twin lead, whatever. Two pieces of coax cable side by side. There's a zillion ways you can efficiently convey your valuable RF transmitter power up to that antenna. And once you start applying a little bit of smart, you can make the impedance match work out right and the balancing function work out right if you're diligent enough to worry about those details. So don't get hung up with the fact that you're following somebody's design and he tells you to use this exact transmission line, that brand name, and that model number. We amateurs are very good at making the inexpensive copy, the Chinese copy, so to speak. What many of us do as amateurs is we say, gee, I want to build a so-and-so widget. And what you do is you dig through your junk box and you pull out all the parts that you think could possibly go into that so-and-so widget. And you now have all the parts that could possibly go into it, and you put them on the table and you say, how can I put these together and make it into a complete system? And when I succeed in doing that, I'm using what I got. I don't have to go out and buy anything. And you'll soon discover that if you're smart enough, there's almost an infinite number of ways of synthesizing a solution once you've gotten up with understanding of the laws of physics of how a capacitor works, how an inductor works, how a transmission works, line works, and how an antenna works. And when it comes to feeding a dipole, as I've indicated to you guys in the past, there's an article I've had added on to Tom Williams of the A1 MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha .org. You go to his website. At the bottom, you'll find information about how to make a perfect, and I mean perfect, impedance match to any dipole. I don't care if that dipole is near the ground or a zillion feet in the air. I don't care if it's buried in the middle of a very elaborate Yagi system or any other kind of a system. If you have a dipole-like driven element, there's a zillion ways you can feed it. And if you're a little bit smart on adjusting length and creating a shunt capacitor or a shunt inductor, you can make that impedance match at your favorite frequency be 1.000 to 1, a perfect match at that frequency if you follow those rules. And it's not that difficult. So there's nothing magic about a quarter wave ground plane. In fact, it's not my favorite antenna. Mounted near the ground, mounted high in the air, is an extremely good antenna. But mounted near the ground, I'm not a fan of that antenna. Some people have mounted them near the ground or on the ground, and they're very happy with them. I would much rather put a ratty old dipole up in the tree than a $350 fancy, shiny thing on the ground. But that's me. K2KEY, K2LIW.
WBKHWW, with a question, please.
Is it on that subject, Howie?
Yes, it is. An inverted G, if you take a halfway dipole, you know, calculated at 75 ohms, halfway dipole. You beat it with 50 ohm cable, and then you start making the antenna sloping. There will come a point where it will give you a proper impedance of 50 ohms, and you will not affect its capacitance or inductance. Am I correct on that? You can find the proper angle for an inverted D where you can feed it with 50 ohm cable. Am I correct in what I'm saying?
You're absolutely correct. You may have to readjust the length as you do that. Let me show you what's going on here, Howie. A pure thin dipole in truly free space. Yeah. You push yourself 100 feet away from the space shuttle, you have this dipole, and you're feeding signal into it. And straight out piece of wire is something very close to 72 ohms, resistive impedance, and no reactance. As you start bringing the dipole into an inverted V, and you make the apex of the V sharper and sharper and sharper, eventually what you call dipole becomes a piece of twin lead when you carry it to the limit. A twin lead, as an antenna, doesn't radiate very well because there's such a small number of wavelengths of spacing between the two sides that it doesn't radiate. It's a kind of twin lead transmission line. So now you've got the twin lead in the limit, quarter wave transmission line, which is an open circuit at the far end. A quarter wave back from an open circuit, a quarter wave of any transmission line, acts as an impedance inverter. Short circuit at one end is open circuit at the other end. So, since the far end of our twin lead limited experiment is an open circuit, at the input end you will see damn close to zero ohm. So as you properly said, as you change the apex angle of a V, you are sliding from 72 ohms toward 0 ohms. And somewhere in there, you're going to be happy because you're using 35 ohm transmission line or 50 ohm or 51 ohm transmission line. You can't get a perfect match. You may have a little reactance left over, which makes you readjust the length, but by adjusting that apex angle, you're adjusting that impedance, as you can see, because you're moving in the direction of making twin lead transmission line through an open circuit on the far end of it. That's one way of adjusting the resistive component. The other way of adjusting the resistive component is to leave the dipole in whatever shape you're starting off with. Maybe it's an inverted V that mechanically just matches your particular power for the center support and your two favorite trees for the end support. You've got a particular shape of your inverted V. Within that shape of the inverted V, not ever changing the shape, but doing nothing but changing the length of the dipole, you have complete independent control of the resistive component. As the dipole becomes zero in length toward one full wavelength in length, your resistive component will go from very close to zero ohms all the way up to multiple thousands of ohms. So by those two curves that are in that article that I wrote, that's at the WA1MBA website, you will see those curves that allow you to adjust the resistive component to any number you want, between one ohm and a few thousand ohms. However, once you choose the length that gives you the right resistive number you like, in general, there'll be some reactance left over. Put the right value of reactance, straight capacitor or whatever, or straight inductor, so to speak, across the center of the dipole to cancel the reactive component. Now the antenna is perfect. So you've got at least two ways of making a perfect impedance match of that dipole, changing the apex angle or changing the length and canceling the reactive component. And there's multiple ways of doing that. Maybe this helps a little bit, Holly. WB2HWW, H-U-R-I-W.
I understand it. Now I'm going to make it. Now let me say this and tell me if you agree with this. It's better off to have a slight mismatch in the resistance. If you got 72 or 75 ohm antenna and you got a 50 ohm antenna, about a 1.5 to 1, you might as well have the inductance, have no inductance or capacitance, have basically a resident antenna and slightly have a mismatch in the R component. Am I saying that correctly?
Absolutely, right on. And you can get a clue about that one, too. And here's two different ways you can get a clue. Number one, you can start putting pure resistors in the end of a transmission line, and you connect it to laboratory instrumentation, and you figure out what's going on. And we all think that if I got 50 ohm transmission line, I should put a 50 ohm resistor plus or minus a tenth of an ohm. We all think that. What happens if the resistor you put there has got a little bit of error to it? If I go all the way down to 25 ohms, or all the way up to 100 ohms, 25 ohms is 50 divided by 2. 100 ohms is 100 multiplied by 2. In those two extreme examples, I only get a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Now, let's do it the other way around. One of my favorite puzzles that I occasionally ask to the smarty pants guys I work with is, hey, what would happen if I take a pure 50-ohm coax cable, I carefully, at my favorite frequency, I carefully adjust the magnitude of capacitance on a pure capacitor, and I make the capacitor reactance exactly 50 ohms. So I hang this 50-ohm capacitor reactance capacitor at the end of my transmission line. If I did that, what standing wave ratio would I have? A significant percentage of the otherwise pretty good engineers will tell me, hey, that's a pretty good match. And then I start saying, okay, let me ask you a couple of questions and see if you still have the confidence of that answer. How much energy is continuously being absorbed by that 50-ohm capacitor if I run the transmitter for the next 10 minutes? If I had a 50-ohm resistor there and I'm running a 1-watt transmitter, I know exactly 1 watt each second, 1 joule of energy each second is going into that resistor. But I don't have a resistor. I put a 50-ohm capacitor. How much energy is being absorbed? Well, after I ask the question 2 or 3 times, I finally get some answers, hey, nothing is being continuously absorbed. Yeah, on the positive half cycle, the capacitor stores some energy, but on the negative half cycle, it gives it back. The net result is the capacitor absorbs no energy. So by conservation of energy, where is the energy going? You're sending it down the transmission line, and the capacitor ain't absorbing it. And finally, he realized, whoa, I mean, that capacitor is reflecting it all back to the transmitter. I say, yes. What do you think the standing wave ratio is? Well, if the reflection coefficient is unity, and you want it to be zero, you mean to tell me the standing wave ratio is infinity? And the answer is yes. So the bottom line of all this is that capacitive or inductive reactants in general, on the end of a transmission line is many times more detrimental to low standing wave ratio by comparison to a mismatched resistor. Restating that, to put it in Howie's words, if you've got reactants there, it's going to hurt you a lot faster. If you've got a reactance error, you want your reactance to be zero. If you have a reactance error, it's going to hurt you a lot faster than if you have a resistance error. Yay, verily. And if you want to go one step further to confirm it mathematically, you can write down your chosen impedance. Open parentheses, 50, comma, J0. Close parentheses. That's a perfect match in the complex mathematics world. And if I have a more general one, open parentheses, 25, comma, J25. Close parentheses. That's a brand new load network. 25 ohms of resistance, 25 ohms of reactance. Once you've got your load on the far end of the transmission line defined mathematically, and you want to find out what is the reflection coefficient magnitude, mathematically, here's how you do it. Write down that impedance twice. Take the upper one, subtract 50 ohms from it, resistively, and put it on the top of the numerator of a fraction. Add 50 ohms to the second one and place it in the denominator of a fraction. And with the right kind of a calculator, perform the division. Divide the denominator into the numerator, and you'll get a complex answer. Then hit the absolute value key. You now know the reflection coefficient. And if it's zero, you're in good shape. If it's unity, that's the maximum bad. And so you play with the numbers. You plug in different values of resistors, you plug in different values of reactors, and you go through the mathematical process. and you'll say, holy cow, boy, reactance hurts you a lot faster than resistance. I think that's what you're trying to say, Howie. Back to you, Howie. Good question, K2LAW.
What I'm saying, Dick, is that a lot of people try to play with the dipole. I say, just put up a dipole, make sure it's resonant dipole, the right formula out of space, and just run your 50-ohm feed line. I have never seen a problem feeding my 50-ohm cable into a 75-ohm cable. The only thing I've ever done, and I've seen it work, is at the end of the dipoles, I've usually made, you know, capacitance hats, or not a capacitance hat, where I'm taking the end of the dipole and bend it back over, like a few inches, and move the, you know, made a loop and moved it back and forth, play with the end of the dipole and see if I can get a better SWR. But from all of my experience, just make the dipole the right length and use a 50-ohm cable. You really don't have to do much matching. As long as you don't have any inductance or capacitance, what's the big deal if you have a little bit of mismatching or resistance?
Yeah, with the way you were folding the end of the dipole, you have two variables in your hand. One is the resultant length of the dipole, that's primarily adjusting the reactive component, but also the resistive component. And then, by the way you bend the end, you're changing the magnitude of the top hat capacitors on the end of the dipole. So if you're skilled in the way you adjust that, you will always get a 50-ohm match. So do you electronically change the length by putting these top hats on it, or do you mechanically change the length by making the wire longer and shorter, or you put chunks of copper, in the case of a VHF antenna, you take some copper tape at the end and place it on there as two top hats. They don't have to be perpendicular to the wire, they can be parallel to the wire. And with a long, thin stick, you're standing out of the field of the antenna. With a long, thin stick, you bend those pieces of copper tape, making the capacitive top hat bigger or smaller, while watching your instrumentation, your standing wave ratio meter, your Bird watt meter looking at reflected power, your network analyzer, it doesn't matter what your instrumentation is. If you do this tuning process, rapidly you'll get a perfect match. So every time I try to publish an article in any of the respected magazines on the zillions of ways of getting a perfect match, even match to a dipole, they always turn it down because they think everybody knows, and I know they don't, and they think the subject is boring. Well, it's the most used antenna in the world, and only a very small percentage of the people who use that most used antenna know how to squeeze the full performance out of it. So it's not known, and it's not boring. That's an opinion. Back to you. I know we went pretty far afield in this one, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Just let me make one more comment on this about amateur radio and dipoles.
Go ahead.
Now I'm going to tell you why cams are very practical. I had no, when I was 13 or 14, had no idea what I was doing, but I said, let me bend the wire over. I played with that dipole, and I found out by making capacitor hats and doing that, I got the SWR down on 6 meters and get out real well. I also found out that I could get rid of some of the TVI if I took some of my seed line and wrapped it around 4 or 5 times. I used to make a dirty ballon that way. Not a matching ballon, but just to keep the current off. And I used to use 50 ohms. Back in old days, you can make a dipole with a couple of egg inflators for under $3 with the feed line from Radio Shack. The cable and the wire cost $3. The radio cost a couple of $100. But that's back in the good old days, like when I was 13 or 14. And no idea, but today I understand that. So just because you use a 50 ohm cable and a 75 ohm antenna, nothing happens. It doesn't blow up. It works.
Yeah, you call that wrap of a few turns of the coax cable near the dipole a dirty balance. I call it a poor man's balance. Works like a charm. Not dirty at all. It's clean. Elegant. And what you're hearing and what Howie was doing is the Edisonian approach. One of the most effective ways of finding the solution of a problem. Try everything. You've heard the story so many times. When Edison was looking for the right material to make the filament of a light bulb, because he wanted to build an electronic light source, an electronic gas light, is probably what he called it in the very beginning. And some reporter asked him, hey, Mr. Edison, how's it going? He says, I haven't found the solution yet, but I've got faith I'm going to find it. I know 2,300 things that don't work, I think it was the 2,600 material he tried that worked. Just keep trying. As long as it's not damaging to the environment or to yourself, it's not expensive, give it a try. Most transmitters nowadays have built-in self-protection circuitry, run them in a low-power mode, and fiddle with it. It's an extremely educational process. It's not going to blow up just because you made some minor variation compared to the article you read in the book. Try it. The dipole itself can be zigzagged, left and right, up and down, spiraled, loading coils in the beginning, the middle, the end, top hat capacitors in the beginning, the middle, the end, shunt capacitors across the center, shunt inductance across the center, all kinds of variations. What Heinrich Hertz did with his dipole invention way back in 1870 or whenever it was, we haven't heard the end of it yet. The most simple, the most basic antenna, you could say we're still inventing it. The story hasn't ended. Stay tuned. K2KUI, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KUI, but I'd still like to answer some gentleman's question about this quarter-wave QRP special called the MWY antenna and why they came up with the 4-to-1 balance stick, because I think there's a little bit more to it than, and I'd like to, like I say, fully answer his question directly.
Okay, if he really is feeding it with 450 ohm lateral line, and if he's using a 4-to-1 impedance ratio balancing device, one possible way of using it is the 450 ohms is being brought back down to roughly 110 ohms or so with the 4-to-1 balance. And can I make a dipole have a resistive impedance of 110 ohms? Easy. Can I make it simultaneously have 110 ohms of resistive component and no reactance? I've got to work a little bit more at it, but yeah, you can do that. But that's a dipole. But he's doing this with a monopole, a quarter-wave ground plane. In general, as I said before many times, a dipole is a pair of monopoles back-to-back. And you just didn't bother putting your sheet of metal down the center. And so you sort of rapidly get the impression of, if I only build half the dipole, and the other half is this great big sheet of metal that's a counterpoise, instead of 70 ohms, I'm going to have 35 ohms. Half the dipole is there, and I'm going to have the impedance. So now, I'm a little bit unclear, because I haven't seen the article, of how you take a basically 35-ohm impedance antenna and get a good match to that when using a quarter-wave, a 450-ohm quarter-wave length of transmission line and a 4-to-1 balance, and only a single balance, if I understand you correctly, not a pair of them. I wouldn't say it can't be done, but it looks at first like a slightly difficult combination. I wonder if you've seen the article on the MWY antenna, Mel, and can you describe it to me? Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, this is K2KUY. It's been around a long time. Very famous antenna with QRP. And it's basically, like I say, a quarter wave ground plane vertical that with 450 ohm ladder line with a 4-to-1 balance connecting into a short piece of coax cable. Now this question was, you know, why I just going to get back again for the many of time to this poor young fellow's question and about using that or why not just the coil. And I know about this, I had read about this antenna some years ago. You would think at first that if it's a 450 ohm ladder line that they're using, that you would want to match it to the 50 ohm cable and use a 9-to-1 balance. But in end, I know it comes out, and that's my nasal, this mic is nasalish, so I know all my ends and ends and whatnot sound the same, but it's a balance, or a balance, all right, with an end. But you would think that the 9-to-1 balance would be, the choice. But the impedance, this is what I want to answer to him, basically, I want to break it down so I understand it, that the Z, the impedance, reflected down a 450 ohm line to the feed point makes a mismatch, makes it highly unlikely there will be anything, 450 ohm resistive down the line anyhow, that's a possibility. that's a very slight possibility. So you would say that, well, with 450 ohms at the end of a 450 ohm line, what will you see? Well, actually, I guess you would see at the end of a 450 ohm line will be 50 ohms only, basically, I want to put this basically so you'll understand it, at the resonant frequency, it will look more like 50 ohms at resonance. But when you start using this type of antenna, from what I understand, at harmonics, you will find that the resistance can go up to like 1,000 ohms. So if you have a halfway transmission line, you would see 50 ohms at the fundamental, but at harmonic, you're going to see 2,000 ohms at the end of this line. So it wouldn't matter really whether it was 450 ohms or 50 ohms or any kind of line, basically. So what do they do here? So what they do here with the line, they use a rod, it's because it has to match this wide variety of impedances. So let's suppose that, well, we're going to vary between, I can say, 50 ohms up to 2,000 ohms, that is harmonic. What kind of balance? Well, if you coil the piece of coax cable, you would have a one-to-one balance to the end. So that coax has, would show an SWR of 1 at 50 ohms. And at 2,000 ohms, you'd have 40. You'd have a 40-to-1. So what they do, they take this 4-to-1 balance, and drops the coax piece to 12.5 ohms. To and a maximum of 500 ohms at the harmonic. So your SWR will be at the maximum, will vary between 4 to 1 and up to 10 to 1. So you see, this is basically the thinking on this antenna stick. In other words, they want to make it so that, he wants to make it so, the guy who designed it, that your SWR using this antenna from its fundamental to its harmonic, that you would never see more than a 10 to 1 SWR. And that's how I analyze this big stick, over.
Yeah, I've got a problem with that now. I first used 35 ohms for the ground plane impedance, and then I used 50. Doesn't matter a great deal. But I assume the twin lead is directly connected to counterpoise and radiator of ground plane. So I'm assuming that the balance is not that end. But even if the balance isn't at that end and I'm wrong, and it's not at the transmitter end, the difference is going to be fairly small. So let me show you what happens. If I first assume that the quarter wave ground plane has a 35 ohm resistive impedance at resonance, and I directly connect a piece of 450 ohm lateral line there that is 90 degrees long. The next question is, what impedance do you see at the input of the 450 ohm line? The answer is 5,800 ohms resistive. If I assume the quarter wave ground plane was 50 ohms instead of 35, I end up with an input impedance of 4,050. In either case, multiple thousand ohms is what you will see on the input end of a piece of 450 ohm lateral line directly connected to that antenna in the way that I described. And now that you've got these either 4,000 or 5,000 ohms impedance at the input end, that's way beyond what you normally match with a balancing device. Even a 10 to 1 balance would only bring 50 ohms up to 500, and you've got to be close to 5,000. So I've either got the wrong topography in my head for what this antenna is, or the transmission line is not 90 degrees long, quarter wave long. I'm just trying to find out what's happening at the fundamental frequency. Not worried about the harmonics yet. So I've got something wrong, and the math is not working out very, very well tonight, Mel. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, this is K2KE. Well, yeah, like I said, I've seen the antenna advertised number, not in QST, it's a small manufacturer that goes off on some of these other periodicals that are, you know, sort of the type that come out, like the newsprint periodicals and all. So it's called the MWY. QRP is special, and they sell a good number of them. run into a number of QRPers, they swear by it. And this is basically like I say how that antenna is constructed with 450 ohm line and a 4-to-1 balance and then a short hunk of coax that connects it to the radio. And basically it's due to the harmonics, the need that that's the reason for the 4-to-1 balance. Originally, an original basically description is see that if you use a, like say, basically some of the people asked here, why can't you use a coiled up piece of coax, because I can see that's only going to give you a 1-to-1. And with the pieces, I should say, going to the white pieces, and that's what he claims that the impedance on his antenna will go from 50 ohms to approximately 2,000 ohms at its harmonics. So what he did, he used his 4-to-1 balance and dropped the coax to 12.5 ohms to 500 ohms. So he finds that this way he'll never show at from an SWR of like 4-to-1 to up to 10-to-1. I mean, that's the thinking on this antenna thing. I don't know. I guess it works. But sure enough, it will be a number of them that are in use, Dick, over.
Okay. If you got a good enough antenna tuner, you can match almost anything. But that is intentionally starting off with a rather strong mismatch. And I will say that when you got your antenna tuner working that hard with roughly a 10-to-1 impedance mismatch, 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, even though you're using the balancing device, which is doing some of the correction, before that you had almost a 100-to-1 ratio, when the antenna tuner is working that hard, it becomes a rather high Q cavity-like structure, which will have fairly strong rejection of harmonics. So it is a way of asking, of knocking the second harmonic and third harmonic down another 20 dB. That combination. But and with QRP, you're not transmitting a lot of power, so even though you've got a lot of percentage of circulating energy in your antenna tuner, and a lot of energy bouncing back and forth from the 450 ohm line, you're not dissipating a lot of power because you're starting off with only 5 watts if you're a QRP operator. As a receiving antenna, I'm not worried. You're going to have a huge mismatch on the average receiver, and it continues to work. If you have any doubt of that, set up your normal antenna, tune to somebody on the 80 or 40 meter band you like listening to, disconnect your antenna, and connect a random length clip lead to the semiconductor of your receiver, and you'll continue to hear the guy. It won't be as much as needed deflection, but the signal-to-noise ratio will be somewhat similar. So just a little random length of wire hanging out the back of your receiver will work, because the receiver is extremely dominant of strong mismatch. Try to transmit back through that random clip lead, and no one's going to hear you except the guy next door. So it's not an efficient radiator. So that's part of what's going on. That whole antenna is still a bit of a mystery to me. To your knowledge, Mel, has anyone ever written up an article giving an analysis of how the antenna is intended to work? K2KEY, K2LIW in the second half.
No, really. This is K2KEY. I just analyzed it from what I saw. Now, I see why he also went to a 4-to-1 balance. I guess he figured that the lower the balance ratio, the wider the balance bandwidth would be, I think. That's the only reason I can directly see the 4-to-1 balance advantage in this case. That's the lower the balance ratio. So it gives a wider balance bandwidth. I would assume that's why he got that 4-to-1 balance there, Dick, over.
So are you saying he's using a 4-to-1 instead of a 9-to-1 balance? In which case, the impedance mismatch seen back at the transmitter and the antenna tuner is considerably higher, more like 100-to-1. I'm wondering how well his antenna tuner can handle something that huge. There's a bit of a mystery. We're missing something here. I can't believe the antenna is intentionally designed to be that much of a mismatch. Back to you, Mel.
just say it's a QRP or antenna. This is a, I'm at, say, one extreme to another. Yeah, 9-to-1 balance. The reason I, from what I can understand, I'm trying to picture a 9-to-1 balance. But if he had a 9-to-1 balance and the impedance would be, let's see, from 5, no, he would wind up with a between 5 to over 200 FWR in a coax. So it would vary from 9 to 4.4. So I guess also the 4-to-1 balance would be, it costs less to make to begin with, Dick, over.
Depending on how you do it. Yeah, 4-to-1 is easy to do with a U-shaped length of half wavelength long coax cable of any impedance. And 9-to-1, I guess the average person building 9-to-1 does it with a coil of wire around a ferrite rod or a ferrite toroid. It's one of the many ways. 3-to-1 voltage ratio, 3-to-1 turns ratio, can give you a 9-to-1 impedance ratio. We got to dig a little deeper into that one, Mel. I'm not sure we've answered very much on this one. I've proven to myself a bunch of reasons why it's not going to work very well, but obviously people are using it, so there's more to the story. Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KY, like I say. It's marketed and it makes people happy, so that's important. I assume that the basic idea of the whole construction system is using the 4-to-1 balance to reduce overall cost and construction and all. And I can see it. Yeah, maybe a 9-to-1, but if you took a 9-to-1, think this out of me, if I took a 9-to-1 transformer, the impedance would transfer me down to, 5.5, and that would give you an SWR. I can't speak it out real quick, I haven't got my calculator. Would give you an SWR of, I bet you, over 200, wouldn't it, Dick? Over.
You're right on. It's a great big number. And boy, that's a hard way to go.
Yeah, I can say there's more to it than this, but maybe I can find some more information on this thing. Like I said, I saw it in passing, so I'm really recalling it, you know. I always, when I see anything with an antenna, you know, I always jump on it and see what the heck somebody comes up with. I always think that somebody, you know, is going to come up with something and I think, oh my God, why not I think of that? But, I can say as long as they're happy with it, but I guess I will answer the question and say yes to the chat, what's his name, Bob, that I think in this case, stay with the 4-to-1 valve as it was designed to do. Decide you must go with this antenna or you have this antenna and do not try to take the 4-to-1 balance out, wrap a piece of coax up and try to make it go from 1-to-1 because I can see in this case it just may not work the same. QRP, like Dick said, you're down to 5 watts, so it's no big deal, you know, with a small tuning, anything. I know on the QRP radios, they make a tuner up and they use a vacuum, they don't use a vacuum, I think they vacuum variable, I say a broadcast variable capacity, you know, from a radio, broadcast radio is sufficient.
WB2HW, you know
what
I
mean?
Go ahead, Mel, you got an explanation of how this antenna works?
No, I wanted to ask actually something on the dipole, if you don't mind, on the inverted V, Dick.
Okay, here's another one of those, and right after that, Mel's going to go to his next email. You got it, Howie.
All right, two questions. On an inverted V, Dick, what is the radiating pattern? Try to explain to me visually, because it's hard for me to. I don't remember it. If you have an inverted V and the apex is up and the antenna comes down at 45 degrees, what is the angle? What is the radiating pattern? Is it more horizontal and vertical? It's not all horizontal, it's not all vertical, right?
You're very close. If I look at the antenna broadside, it is a pure vertical, correction, pure horizontal radiator. Let me repeat that. You've got an inverted V, and I'm looking at it broadside. Let's see, my inverted V goes from east to west, and I'm looking at it from the north or from the south. It is a pure horizontally polarized antenna. A little bit complicated to figure out where the radiation center is, how many wavelengths above ground, to figure out what the vertical elevation angle is. But it's a pure horizontal antenna, and I'm really looking at a bird's eye. Again, this dipole inverted V is going from east to west, and I now look at it from the east or from the west. From the east or from the west, I'm looking at the end of the dipole. It is pure vertical polarization. Broadside, it was pure horizontal. Endwise, it's pure vertical. It has no nulls. That's the beauty of that antenna, one of the many beauties, no nulls. And depending on how much you raise the center versus the end, you are determining the magnitude of the vertical polarized pattern off the end versus the magnitude of the horizontal pattern broadside. Your next question, of course, is going to be, what happens when I look at it halfway between horizontal, halfway between the ends and halfway between broadside? In other words, it's an east-west antenna, and I look at it from the southwest or the southeast. What do I see? You see partial horizontal, partial vertical. Therefore, you're going to either see slant polarization or slight elliptical. Let me think about that now. The phase center, you're going to see partial elliptical polarization with the major axis of the ellipse, I think, at close to a 45-degree angle. So, if you want to radiate signal everywhere in space and have no nulls off the end, an inverted V has got a lot going for it. A slightly more elaborate version of that, with a couple of more twists to it, I've been experimenting with for the last week and a half at the salt mine, and we find that the antenna has no nulls anywhere in three-dimensional space, and if I choose the highest peak and the lowest valley in three-dimensional space, and I'm looking at total energy, regardless of horizontal, vertical, circular, or whatever, it's extremely close to a isotropic antenna. Now, whenever anyone talks about isotropic, they usually are talking about isotropic with linear polarization. And these exotic bends that we're talking about of dipole-like structures, it's not purely linear polarization anymore. It's got different polarizations depending on where you look at it from. And in some cases, you've got partial circular or elliptical polarization. But you and I have heard for so many years, Howie, that an isotropic antenna doesn't exist. Depending on your definition, I think it does exist. Back to you, Howie.
Now, let me ask you a question. Did you do what I think you did, because this is what I'm thinking of doing for my 10 meters. I'm thinking of taking two inverted Vs, mounting them on a pole, mounting them both on a pole, one going northeast, so one going north-south, one going east-west, both having them exactly coming out, you know, as an inverted V made out of rod, taking the two antennas and feeding them 90 degrees out of phase, that if I use 50-ohm cable, I'll come out with 25 ohms, and if I use some kind of way to get it back up to 50, that's fine. But is that what I'm thinking of, what your idea is? Because I had that idea in my head. I will say one thing about an inverted V. I've used inverted Vs on 6, I've used them on 20, and they are some of the best antennas. I love inverted Vs because they just seem to pick up very well. They seem to work real well. Now, is that what you're thinking of, is taking two inverted Vs and having them going in two different directions? And then basically beating them out of phase?
Okay, what you're describing is a subset of a turnstile antenna. A turnstile antenna normally has a pure flat-out east-west dipole and a pure flat-out north-south dipole, and you feed them 90 degrees out of phase. It's a famous antenna that's been used for FM reception of FM broadcasts. Yes, which is usually vertically polarized, horizontally polarized. So turnstile antenna, and sometimes you put an S-curve in each of those dipoles, that became a commercial product. And now you want to go one step further and make the east-west dipole an inverted V and the northwest dipole an inverted V. And you can go beyond that and say, one of the inverted Vs I'm going to curve down, the other one I'm going to curve up. That doesn't make much of a difference, by the way. It's just a matter of convenience. So you're making an inverted V turnstile, and that's one step further into the area of nearly uniform signal strength on all composite headings around the 0 to 360 degrees of azimuth, and because of no nulls anywhere, it's also a perfect circular polarized antenna, straight up and straight down. You could use it for a satellite receiving antenna of circular polarization. So yes, that's going to be a good antenna. By the way, since the inverted V, one single inverted V, has no nulls anywhere, the next question is, what do you gain by building the turnstile version of an inverted V? And the answer is a little more clearly defined polarization. When you build a turnstile version of an inverted V, you will, at every compass heading, see nearly purely horizontal polarization. Let me think about that for a minute. No, that ain't true. I ain't sure what polarization you're going to see. I'm not quite sure what advantage you gain by making a turnstile version of an inverted V versus a single inverted V. Right now, I'm not quite sure. I know there's going to be a slight difference. Is one better than the other? One takes a little more hardware, and is it going to give you better performance in the, on the air? Well, as Mel is finding out, once you're deciding to use the frequencies where the ionosphere is active in your communication band, you're going to have to accept the fact that Faraday rotation of polarization is a dominant factor that no one has talked about very much. You listen to your buddy from London transmitting a signal to you, and whether he started off horizontal or vertical in polarization, by the time it gets to the ionosphere and gets to your house in Queens, it's been through a number of twists of polarization. And when it gets to you, is it horizontal, vertical, slant 45, circular polarized? The answer is yes to all of the above, depending on what day, what hour of the day, where is the terminator, and so on. Mel is discovering and rediscovering that once you have polarization agility in your receiving antenna, and I'm sure it's also true for the transmitting antenna, once you have polarization agility, you can tune it slightly differently each day and peak up that signal, get the best possible signal-to-noise ratio. The majority of the antennas we amateurs have used up till now did not have polarization agility. It's another trick in our bag that we should start using, because under certain conditions it's going to give you a heap of a big benefit. Back to you, Howie.
Absolutely, Dick. I've noticed this when I was back on, you know, in the 70s operating in different bands. Now, the reason why I'm thinking of making the inverted V this way is that I'm not going to be able to tune the angle or the polarity of the antenna, you know, horizontal or vertical. It's going to be on top of a repeater site, or it's going to be a 10-meter receiver. And what I'm finding out, what other guys are finding out, is you can sit at your house at a low location, use a dipole or a horizontal beam, and hear better than a repeater site with a vertical, say, 400 or 500 feet up in the air or whatever. A lot of guys are playing around with this. A couple of repeater owners on 10 meters are playing around with horizontal antennas, different antennas, to try to get better reception of, you know, E-skip or F-skip, you know, mobile, other stations 800,000 miles away. So basically 10 meters, people are fooling around with it, not for local coverage, but mainly for the DX. And we're not really worried about the transmit antenna. You know, that could just be a vertical or whatever. It's the receive antenna. So you think just a simple inverted V, and you don't think I'll see much more of a difference if I go to two inverted Vs. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit more complicated because I'm going to have 250-ohm transmission lines, come down to a T, you know, the phasing harness, then I'm going to come out with 25 ohms, then I got to have a 2-to-1, you know, have to come up with a quarter-wave transformer to come back up to 50 ohms. So you don't think I'll see much of a difference, and you don't think it's that important if the antenna is either east or west or north or south. You feel that it will receive pretty well all around. All right. I'm still thinking of trying a two inverted Vs, but mechanically it is going to be a little bit more complicated.
I got a suggestion for you, Howie. and there's a 50-50 chance you're about to find a breakthrough in 10-meter antennas if you follow the advice I'm about to give you. I didn't say it's easy, but you've got the resources. A 10-meter dipole is roughly 16 feet long. With reasonable mechanical construction techniques, one inverted V-like dipole 16 feet long, or a pair of them, is not very difficult for you to come up with. What's going to be a little bit more elaborate, but I know you can do it, you could make a remotely controlled relay network at the antenna, giving you the ability to first transmit only into the horizontal via east-west inverted V. That's position number one of the relays. Position number two, you transmit only into the north-south inverted V. And position number three, you transmit into both of them in the turnstile manner. If you really want to have some fun, position number four is turnstile manner with opposite sensing. So that in one case, viewed from the top, is transmitting clockwise circular. In the other case, viewed from the top, is transmitting counterclockwise circular. With those relays remotely controlled, while you're doing transmission tests or reception tests, and you can now find out today at 3 in the afternoon on 10 meters which one of those three or four combinations gives the best reception. That would be a fun thing to try. Look at something else that you can do. I'm not recommending this one, but for a quick experiment, boy, it would be a beauty. If you do a real good job of making the east-west inverted V and the north-south inverted V truly orthogonal to each other, exactly 90 degrees, truly east-west, truly north-south, in my example, you then have the ability to transmit into the east-west, receive from the north-south, and with that orthogonality of 20-25 dB of isolation, you've now drastically decreased the requirement for the tuning of your duplexing filter of this repeater. You've got isolation between the two. I'm not recommending that because I'm a little bit worried about having, in some directions, you'll be a rabbit, in other directions, you're going to be an alligator. Those are repeater terms, and you know what I'm talking about. But still, with remotely controlled relays, guarantee you're going to have a grand old time testing this thing. I give you a 50-50 chance you'll make a breakthrough when you do that test. WV2HWW, K2RIW.
Dick, understand we're not running duplex, we're running split sites. The receiver and transmitter are about 9 or 10 miles apart. Yeah, the ideas of using relays are fine, but the problem is this, if you're talking to a bunch of people, the repeater is receiving one person, and, you know, multiple people are talking to, there may be a different idea. The idea is this, is to get an all-around antenna that's going to give you, not going to be great, you know, going to be good, it's going to be a compromise. You're trying to get a compromise of the antenna. Yes, you can use relays. What I'm trying to do is co-phase, is phase these antennas. It won't matter if you're getting more of a vertical signal one day or you're getting more of a horizontal signal one day. If you're talking to your favorite buddy, let's say it's in Florida, and he's talking to his favorite buddy out in Ohio and the band is open and they're using a repeater in, let's say, New York, what you really want to happen is the antennas try to favor both stations. One day, I've seen it where one day you get a better reception on a vertical, the next day you get a better reception on a horizontal, or in the middle of the queue, so as you're talking to someone, he might go from full quieting on the vertical to full quieting on the horizontal and get noisy on the vertical. So the idea is this, is to get something that's going to be no worse than 3 dB down from either plane. Go ahead.
Yeah, even though you've got an active repeater and people are in a conversation and you're not part of the conversation, you as a repeater operator can still run a very effective experiment there, Howie. Either you're at the repeater site itself and you're looking at the controls, or it's a remote base-like thing, and by some telemetry, whether it be VOIP or whatever, by some telemetry technique, you know what the limiter current on the receiver is doing, the signal strength meter is, your RSSI is indicating, and whatever. But while the conversation is proceeding, there's nothing stopping you from flipping the relays such that the receiving antenna, not the transmitting antenna, the receiving antenna goes from mode 1 to mode 2 to mode 3, and you can choose the one that gives the best...